Good morning and welcome to Manzanita Voices. This is your host, Linda Fields. Hope you had a wonderful week and that you're all ready for some good listening this morning. I have a wonderful guest. His name is Glenn Wasson. He's a member of our Writers Unlimited writing group in San Andreas. And Glenn is going to be with me in just a moment. We're going to be talking about a lot of things with him. But first, I have a couple of things from Morning Workout. And these tie in with the first poem of Glenn's that he's going to read. We're having a kind of a sports kickoff to this morning with softball and baseball. And so I'm going to read a submission from Monica Rose. She's our great leader and the mother of all of us writers in Calaveras County. And Monica published a book, of course, you know, you hear me talking about it all the time. It's called River by the Glass. And on page 68, she has a poem where she was using softball as a metaphor for writing poetry and finding just the perfect word for what you're trying to say. Slow pitch poetry. You make contact with a word, with your tongue, and throw it to first base. In the field, you catch the high fly, feel it clump into your glove, and form another circle of speech, complete. At bat, there's a crack, and it's a fast grounder. Shortstop receives the call, the gift of finishing the utterance in one breath. The grounder going into the stitched mitt. Though you feel the bad hop of a maligned metaphor, there's the snap to first base, and the poet receives the throw. It's an out! It's an out! Softball wisdom rushes to your head. For the throw or pitch, catch or hit, words will flow. Softball wisdom feels the sweet spot in the mitt and at the bat, and knows you have to wait for the word to descend. Keep your eye on it every second and wait for it to drop. Wait for it until you can hardly stand it. Monica Rose, slow pitch poetry. That kind of reminds me of Zoe Keithley's writing group too in Sacramento, because Zoe in her group, Story Workshop Writers, she spends a lot of time helping people open their minds and their psyches so that they find just that right word and they find the sweet spot in their writing. It's wonderful. Now, the next one I'm going to read for Morning Workout, and I just rustled the paper and I promised myself I wasn't going to do that. I'm trying to do this quietly. This next one is by Martha Mallory. She's another member of our writers group. And Martha likes to write about early man, and she likes to connect what early man, how they lived, and what they were doing to survive, and how some of the techniques that they learned carry over into modern day sports. Pretty interesting combination there. So Martha's poem is about baseball. Early man stalks out from the cave, his muscles and sinews so vibrantly brave. He picks up his club and goes hunting for prey, wondering what he will eat for dinner that day. After thousands of years, our modern man stalks, not from the cave, but a half-sunken box. He picks up his bat, his heart beats aloud, as he faces the cheers and the thrill of the crowd. Again, he is hungry and hunting for prey, though symbolic the ball, still rewarding the pay. As he swings with the might that his ancestors knew, he is man, still the hunter, primeval and true. Civilization may flourish and stone ages fall, but man will not part with his bat and his ball. What fun. That's great. Thank you, Martha, for letting me read that for Morning Workout. Now, I'm going to introduce you to our guest, Glenn Wasson. Glenn, it's really nice to have you with us today.
Well, thank you. It's very nice of you to invite me.
Well, I love having you on the program. You were my guest once before, and you came on as Black Bart, that notorious lascivious stagecoach robber. And for the listeners who are not aware, Glenn is a fabulous impersonator of Black Bart. He dresses up in costume, wears the cape and the whole nine yards, and he goes out and robs stagecoaches in Calaveras County here every once in a while, just to keep the ghost of Black Bart alive. And he does a wonderful job with that. So, Glenn, you have a poem that you wrote about baseball. Would you read it for us? Tell us the name of it, and then read the poem for us.
The name of it is "Why Do Baseball Players Spit?" Why do baseball players spit? I've never known the cause of it. For years upon the ground they've spat. No other sport is known for that. Now in the game of basketball, you never see them spit at all. In golf, lacrosse, or round of skeet, a spitter you will never meet. Football tacklers love to clobber a running back, but they don't slobber. In skiing, biking, and winter skating, you'll never see expectorating. In days of old, first-class saloons were furnished with ornate spittoons. An expectorant could launch his fume and hit that thing across the room. Nowadays, cuspidors are seldom found, so baseball players use the ground. And at the plate where batters wait, with cheeks distended, they pound the plate. With cleated shoes, they paw the dirt, and toward the mound they launch a squirt, a gesture some might call profane, to show the pitchers their disdain. For years I've tried to ascertain this practice I cannot explain. Why does each batter think that spitting will help his odds for lifetime hitting?
Oh, that's good. That was lots of fun. And it was really a lot of fun the night that you and Martha read your poems to our writers group. We had a lot of good fun with that. Now, Glenn, you write doggerel. What is doggerel exactly?
Well, doggerel is the lowest form of poetry, and it's held in very low regard. It's usually in rhyme and covers very trivial subjects. But there is a form of poetry that is even worse than doggerel, and it is called mogrel. And I've been known to slip from doggerel to mongrel. And I've received nothing but bad comments about my work when I slipped that badly. So occasionally I'll move up to doggerel.
I think you're just being too modest, because you are so entertaining when you read your doggerel. And there's lots of it in your book, which is called Tales Mark Twain Would Have Loved to Steal. And we're going to hear some of that later. I've seen you recite in front of audiences, and I know how much you entertain them. And none of them thinks it's mongrel at all. So we have just a couple minutes here before we have to break. Tell your story. You submit a lot of your work, not just poetry, but also little articles that you've written. You submit a lot of that to magazines. And you have a story about something that you submitted, I think it was to the Reader's Digest years ago. And it kind of had a circular story to it, a circular life to its endurance here. So would you tell us about what happened with that? Maybe it'll encourage people who get rejection letters all the time.
Well, I wrote a story that the group that heard it said, it sounds like a Reader's Digest story. Why don't you send it in to them? So I sent it in, and I got a prompt rejection. One thing about the Reader's Digest that I like, you get prompt rejections. You don't wait and wait and wait. So anyway, in the meantime, I submitted it to the Christian Science Monitor, and they published it, and we got quite a bit of mail on the editorial page that they printed. And so then I resubmitted it to the Reader's Digest as a reprint. And they rejected it just as fast the second time. So in the course, now I'm talking about several years that have gone by, the Christian Science Monitor put out an anthology of their stories that they thought were worthy of reprinting and picked out mine. And in this anthology were Pulitzer Prize winning authors.
Wow.
People that I'm not used to associating with. And several months later, after this anthology came out, the Reader's Digest contacted me and asked my permission to publish this article. Well, I couldn't help but feel a little smug at this point. And I said, you know, you've seen that article on three occasions and rejected it. What makes it so much better now? And they said, well, editors come, editors go. Sometimes we feel differently on Monday mornings than we do on Friday afternoons. So let's face it, the choice of many written articles and stories is a very subjective operation. And so if you write anything that you think is good or anybody else thinks is good, if you keep exposing it enough, you'll find somebody else who thinks it's good and worthy of publication. So be persistent in what you write and what you submit it to.
Good advice from Glenn Watson. We'll be right back. Manzanita Voices, and we're talking today with Glenn Watson. We just heard him read one of his poems, and then he was talking about how he got rejected three times by the Reader's Digest, and then finally they contacted him and asked if they could publish the same article they had rejected. So Glenn, during the break, you were just telling me a lot of stuff about what editors are looking for and what you've learned, because you have submitted to magazines for many years. So what were you saying about what editors look for?
Well, editors normally are working months ahead of any particular publication date, and quite often they're working on a theme of some subject that is of general interest to the public. And if you submit something in time for fitting that theme, you're more apt to get published than having written a masterpiece on something else. Almost every magazine, popular magazine, will have kind of a theme issue for the holidays. 4th of July, Halloween, Christmas, Easter, whatever. And if you can write something probably at least 6 months in advance, because that's the way they're put together, they're looking months ahead. If you can send some little article in that's humorous, that has a lot of pathos or human feeling to it, editors will gobble up that stuff a lot faster than they will the standard writing. And as I've been both an editor and a writer, and I find that I crack the national magazines more frequently with small articles that will fit a theme.
What do you mean by small?
Well, many magazines right on the last page will have a humorous article, and it will just fit one page. And of course, we have a lot of flexibility as editors. You can fill in with pictures and illustrations and so forth. So anything that will fill one page that is applicable to the time of the year or the holiday, or if you know in advance it's going to be a theme article, like sports cars or something like that, mm-hmm. and send something in that is applicable to that, you'll have a lot better chance of being accepted.
That's good advice. How many magazines, different names of magazines, would you say you've submitted to over the years? I know you've submitted to Reader's Digest, and what are some of the other ones you've seen where you've been published?
Well, I've had a number of things published in the Christian Science Monitor. I've had a number of things published in the Military Officers Magazine.
Because you're a retired Air Force jet pilot. Mm. What was your rank when you retired?
I was a full colonel.
Oh, okay. That's impressive. So you've been in the military magazines. And what other magazines?
Oh, Country Magazine, Soldier of Fortune Magazine. I'm trying to think of a number of local publications, like the San Francisco Chronicle.
What did you have that was in the Chronicle?
I had an article about skiing in Japan in the travel section of the Sunday Chronicle. And it was a big article, by the way. I had a lot of pictures, and it covered the whole front page and went into several back pages. And it covered the differences between skiing in Japan and all their funny little practices, and skiing in this country. And what was the name of it? Skiing in Japan is no snow job.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Now, you got paid for that article, right?
Now, that's a long story.
Ooh.
First of all, my experience with the San Francisco Chronicle is like dropping a note in a bottle and throwing it in the ocean. You just never hear from them. Even when you send in a self-addressed stamped envelope, they won't even send it back. The only exception was Herb Cain. Herb Cain was wonderful. Of course, I think he's wonderful because he used some of my stuff. But when he didn't, he always wrote a personal note to you and say, "Hey, thanks, Glenn. Keep them coming. I can't use this." But on the ski article, I didn't hear for months from them. And so I called the travel editor, and I said, "If you're not going to use that, would you please send it back?" And he said, "Well, we're featuring it this coming Sunday." Well, they hadn't even notified me that it had been accepted, and now it's going to be the feature article in their travel section. If I'd have been out of town, I'd have missed it completely.
Oh, for goodness sake. Wow.
So, anyway, weeks go by, and nobody pays me for this. And so I call them up again. I said, don't you pay for your feature articles in the... "Oh, yeah, we'll have to talk to the disbursing officer or whoever." So eventually I got maybe $200-$300 out of the article. But I had to twist their arms to get it.
Wow. Well, that's good for people to know, people who are writing and wanting to send things out. You really have to be patient. You have to follow up, and you have to almost become a pest sometimes.
Yeah.
But don't step over the line, because if you become too much of a pest, they'll just throw your stuff out and they won't pay any attention to you.
One thing that I found in writing, if you're accepted in a magazine, always make certain you catch the name of the editor that approves that. Because you are probably in bed with that author. They think the same way you do. I've gone for years with the same editor. And then I'll get a rejection from the same magazine or something I think is pretty good. I'll look at the signature, and it's somebody I've never heard of before. And so you just stay afloat with somebody that accepts your word or your work and keep occupied with things that you've written.
Well, and that makes sense, because if a particular editor likes what you do, you mm-hmm. click. And so now with computers, it might be easy to follow that editor. If they leave one magazine and go to another one,
well, that's possible.
It might be pretty easy to track them down with computers and find out where their new place is. And of course, if the people above them allow them the leeway that they should have to be able to make their choices, then you probably still have an in with them.
That's possible, but I haven't had any luck at all following up on replacement editors. Several times I thought, well, I'll send something in to the replacement editor. Mm-hmm. And I know it's not bad, because I'll submit it to some other magazine and they'll publish it.
Well, I guess editors are, they are just human beings, and there's a chemistry. There's some people click with them right away and other people don't. It's just like, I suppose, anything else. But the bottom line of what you're saying is you have to be persistent.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to plan ahead. And magazines and newspapers do pay for their work. You've got to make sure you track them down if you don't get a check right away. Mm-hmm. But you should, I think one of the really most important things you've said also in this conversation is that people should plan ahead. If you're writing in the springtime, think about sending out things for Christmas
mm-hmm.
or for the holiday season.
Mm-hmm.
Think more than half a year ahead and get it out there, and you might just get lucky and have your work published. That's great.
I've had that experience in that I've submitted things 2 or 3 months before the holiday, and they come back rejecting it because it was too late. I mean, they couldn't use it time-wise, because the paper or magazine was pretty well composed.
Yeah. Was there a magazine that, what do you think is the best paying one to submit to? Is there any one that's better than another for paying a good price, a fair price?
Most of them don't pay enough. It's barely a pittance what they pay sometimes for the lead article in national magazines. The Reader Digest is known for paying well. Playboy is known for paying very well. I never cracked Playboy, and I submitted a number of things to them. It's kind of a poor way to make a living if you think you're going to make a lot of money writing for being a freelance writer for magazines. Now, of course, if you get syndicated, then that's something else. You're big and your money will roll in. But
if you're a syndicated author and you have several different magazines mm-hmm. taking it, well, yeah, that mm-hmm. must be wonderful when that happens. You know what? We're out of time for this segment, Glenn. You've got to give these folks a break for a moment, and then we'll be right back.
Okay.
Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. We're talking with Glenn Lawson. And Glenn, you were in the Air Force. What years did you serve? And tell us a little bit about what you did.
I entered the Air Force in 1950 and retired in late 1979. So I had close to 30 years in the Air Force.
Wow, that's great. And you served in Vietnam?
Yes, I've been to Vietnam, Korea. My career was kind of unique in that I started as a navigator and bombardier in Korea, then went to pilot training after that tour, and eventually came back to Vietnam as a forward air controller. So I've known combat in all three ratings.
Wow, that's quite a background.
And I've written quite a bit about Vietnam, but mostly I'm looking for humorous incidents in Vietnam. And they're hard to find. Vietnam was not a very funny war. There's a lot of written about it, but you'll look and you won't find much humor in coming out of Vietnam.
Oh, that's for sure. Vietnam and Korea both, although we did get MASH out of Korea.
Yeah.
And that was wonderful. But well, war in general is not funny at all. Anybody who can find the humor is definitely an optimist. And I think you must be an optimist because you did write some funny things. Mm. Now, what you're going to read for us now is something about your military service, or a story that came out of your military service. And it was recently published in one of your professional newsletters. Tell us about that.
All right. This is called The Squadron Coward. Military literature staggers under a load of countless volumes, extolling the value of heroes, both historic and current. But where does one find a sympathetic account of the common coward who served and suffered combat in silence, seldom if ever receiving any credit for persevering in the face of constant peril? It rarely comforts the weak of heart to be told that a coward dies a thousand deaths, a brave man only once. Because cowards outnumber heroes by at least 100 to 1, it only seems fitting that the fearful should receive some form of recognition. I had the privilege of knowing a self-proclaimed coward who served with the 3rd Bomb Wing at Kunsan, Korea in 1952. He was a fellow navigator who flew night interdiction missions over North Korea. Besides flying combat missions, all officers in the squadron were assigned ground duties. This was supposed to round out our managerial experience, but more importantly, furnish our superiors with observations that could be reflected in our officer effectiveness reports. It required considerable creativity to provide each of us with an impressive sounding position. We had a squadron athletic officer, VD prevention officer, health and sanitation officer, awards and decorations officer, transportation officer, mail officer, casualty reporting officer, mess inspection officer, morale officer, rat extermination officer, insect control officer, education officer, and other imaginative titles that gave each of us a separate identity and some minor area of responsibility. One billet not authorized by the Air Force Table of Allowances was that of Squadron Coward. However, one of our new members arrogated this previously unfilled position and proclaimed loudly at the bar in the officers' club that he was terrified in the performance of his duties. He had an encyclopedic catalog of every conceivable hazard that might be imagined. Our mission required flying the black-painted B-26 on 4 or 5 hour night missions over North Korea to detect and destroy any moving traffic, either on railroads or on highways. On a typical night, we put up an average of 15 flights, and usually had 15 returning planes before daylight the next morning. But inevitably, there were some nights when one or two planes did not return. We never knew what happened to them. They seldom radioed a distress call. They just disappeared into a black hole that swallowed planes and crews without a hint of what went wrong. Of course, unknown hazards are always more fearful than obvious perils, because a person's imagination can manufacture all sorts of frightening scenarios to explain the unexplainable. Our squadron coward had an imagination unfettered by any reasonable expectation of coming events. His plane would likely be incinerated by a lightning strike or collide with a flight of night flying geese. Even less credible were rumors that the Russians were introducing experimental night fighters. Always possible were engine failures or flak damage resulting in nighttime daylights in total darkness over hostile territory, capture and prolonged torture by sadistic guards, slow starvation in North Korean prison camps, crashing into obscure mountaintops during low-level scrapings, striking unmarked high-tension lines, mid-air collisions with other aircraft, blast and shrapnel damage from flying too low over your own bomb drops.
I just have to interject here that I can't. Oh my goodness, I would think everybody would be a coward. That's a whole long list of just awful things to happen. Okay, we're finding the manuscript.
Oh, I guess you have to write over.
Transitioning from one page to the next. Okay, we've had that long list of horrible
this
things.
This is more of the long list.
More of those. Yeah. Oh, more yet. Oh, I can't wait to hear it.
Tethered balloons with hanging steel cables over likely targets. Pilots blinded by searchlights who lost control too close to the ground. These and many more catastrophes were elaborated in the most lugubrious language. It was a miracle that any of us were still alive. We had the life expectancy of a balloon on New Year's Eve. Of course, all of us concealed some of the same apprehensions, but we were too concerned with our macho image to express them. The squadron coward made the rest of us appear fearless by comparison, and we began to appreciate his contribution to our undeserved reputations for disdaining danger. But with that insight was the annoying realization that it took more courage to admit your fears before your comrades than concealing them with typical military bravado. Our squadron coward eventually achieved a respected status and helped all of us feel better about ourselves. I hope that someday an appropriate decoration is awarded to all self-proclaimed cowards who faithfully serve their country in spite of overwhelming anxiety. Now, I have a postscript to this article, and it goes like this. Public squares throughout the world are decorated with statues of heroes who fomented and won wars with undaunted courage. But where have you ever seen a statue to a statesman or military leader who prevented the war? I think the time has come to recognize these, quote, cowardly, unquote, leaders who judiciously pursue peace in preference to belligerence.
I think that's a wonderful idea. Yes, let's have statues to people who promote peace. And then all those squadron cowards can retire and go home and and just do their gardening, right? That's great. That was a lot of fun, Glenn. In the next segment, we're going to hear Glenn read a little bit of his book, Tales Mark Twain Would Have Loved to Steal. We cannot let him get away without giving us some of that marvelous stuff. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Back to Manzanita Voices. This is Linda Fields, and we're talking today with Glenn Watson, a great personality and entertainer and all-around great guy in Calaveras County.
And it's such a pleasure to have you on the show with today, Glenn. And right now, we're going to hear something from Glenn's book. And he has the book open to the pages. This particular thing is called Sunday Night in Valley Springs. It's a true story of something that's happened in Valley Springs. But Glenn knows this so well, he's going to recite it for us. So, here we go. You're going to tell us about when did this happen, Glenn?
Oh, this happened probably 10, 15 years ago. And it's a story of a well-known renegade cowboy by the name of Willis Hammett.
So he's a real person. And only 10 or 15 years ago, I thought this happened maybe 100 years ago.
No, it made all the newspapers, national press. Everybody was laughing because the highway patrol was going to take his license away for riding a horse.
That's right. I guess the highway patrol wasn't around 100 years ago. I forgot that they were in the poem. So, yeah, wonderful. So, let's hear it.
An aura clings round old Valley Springs as a sensible sort of a place. Not that it mattered, but this image was shattered by a dirty and shameful disgrace. One dark Saturday night, without the aid of a light, a cowboy rode his horse into town to have a few beers and the gossip one hears when a bunch of the boys gather round. Several six packs of beers, like loose bandoliers, crossed his tattered old vest. In case his thirst grew, he could reach for a brew so conveniently hung on his vest. But he favored those places that were endless oases, that offered all manner of drinking, where he could sample their wares and abandon his cares among laughter and glasses a-clinking. As the hours sped by, several beer kegs drained dry. Voices joined in verses quite raucous, for our cowhands could hold with the tipplers of old, who emptied the wineskins of Bacchus. When his mind clouded up, he abandoned his cup and staggered blearily out into the street. Lacking common amenities, he shouted obscenities at the terrified people he'd meet. Now our hero, quite haggard, to his horse gamely staggered, which he mounted after falling off twice. Then he galloped up place like a wild chariot race, while pedestrians scattered like mice. In hopes of some peace, they called the police, who arrived with a flashing red light. They found the intruder sounding louder and ruder, challenging everyone there to a fight. The patrolman took note and officiously wrote a detailed and lengthy citation. And when he issued the ticket, the cowhand told him to stick it in a place needing no explanation. To make the cop madder, the horse emptied his bladder, splashing boots like new falling rain, and when the cop stepped aside, the horse added with pride fresh manure to show his disdain. "I'm taking your license, drunk driving," the officer angrily cried. The cowboy said, "Shaw, ain't no place in the law where I need a license to ride." While the cop scratched his head, the loyal quadruped took stock of his master's sad plight. He started home plodding, with the rider's head nodding, and they disappeared into the night. The policeman, perplexed, knew not what to do next. When he realized the pair was at large, it didn't make sense to press the offense when the horse, not the man, was in charge.
I love that. Love that. Oh my goodness. I hadn't heard that for a while. So it's a real treat to hear it again.
What else would you like to hear from the book?
This book. This book, which happens to be called Mark's Tales, Mark Twain Would Have Loved to Steal. And Glenn has come out with a new edition of the book. It was first published in what year, Glenn? When did the first one come out?
The first book?
Yeah.
I think it was in 2008.
Okay, 2008. And then this newer version, which you added.
This is a revised edition that came out a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm constantly revising and making this book larger. And eventually I would like to wrap everything up in a hardcover edition.
Oh, that would be really nice. Yeah, I can't wait for that. Now, on the cover of this book is a picture of a gold pan, where the miners used to use panning for gold, and in that pan is a beautiful gold nugget, and there is a black gloved hand reaching for the nugget to steal it, and that hand is actually yours, and the gold nugget is also actually yours, and it's on display at the museum at Ironstone Winery, right?
Yes, I had it on consignment there. Did you want to hear the rest of the story?
Yes, let's hear the story of that famous gold nugget. And this is true also, and this happened in Murphy, in Calaveras County, within the last 20 years, I believe. So it's another recent story from the gold country. See, folks, we still have stuff going on here, even though they're not bringing so much gold out of the ground anymore. There are still a lot of gold rush stories. And Glenn is going to impart this one to us now.
Well, thank you. When Bret Hart and Mark Twain were in this territory, they found that it was a very rich area for things that they could write about. And it was a the mother lode of interesting details and occurrences. For example, the jumping frog story and a number of things that Bret Hart wrote about. So this is my version of something that took place in the bar room of the Murphy's Hotel. It was picked up by the wire services, went all over the country, and used as humorous fillers in newspapers. I've been told that it was on the front page of the New York Times. Johnny Carson talked about it on the Tonight Show. That up in Calaveras County, they spiked their beer with gold nuggets. Anyway, this is my version of that occurrence. Many tall tales are told of the old mother lode from the pens of Bret Hart and Mark Twain to this treasury of Lord upon us bestowed is another. Please let me explain. One boisterous night in the Murphy's Hotel, as the patrons lined up at the bar, an event took place too dubious to tell. 'Twas unseemly, quite gross, and bizarre. A miner walked in with an obvious grin and ordered drinks for the roistering crowd. The bar settled down to let him begin, which he did with a manner quite proud. From out of his pocket a nugget he panned, was placed where everyone saw, to be fondled and handled in every hand, an object of envy and awe. When a patron inquired where the miner had dug it, a drinker slipped it into his beer, thinking, I'll have me that nugget, I'll just chug-a-lug it, and with one gulp made the beast disappear. The bar room was stunned, but the miner was cool. From out of his belt came a knife, saying, cough up that nugget, you guzzling fool, if you want to enjoy further life. The collower coughed and inhaled, but utterly failed to make a timely resurgence. So they locked him in jail without any bail to wait for the nugget's emergence. A three-day transition from mouth to emission is a well-known medical fact, or so it was said by a local physician of a normal intestinal tract. But 3 days came and went, and he failed to expel, which greatly heightened attention. A watch was put on the prisoner's cell, now the object of drawing attention. Oh, but I cannot unveil in graphic detail the facts of the nugget's appearance. Decorum in poetry must prevail to shield the more gentle adherence. But it came to pass on the seventh day when the guard heard the prisoner shout, unlock my cell, I'm on my way, that damnable nugget came out. The authorities gathered, to examine the stool, a procedure I could not recommend. Not the normal discovery of gold as a rule, but all's well that comes out in the end.
Oh my, that's priceless. And it's a true story. And the Murphy's Hotel is still there, of course, because this is a recent story. And you can go have a drink there at the bar any time. And that nugget is, you tracked it down. You took time to track that.
Yes, uh-huh. But the nugget is actually on display over at the Ironstone Winery in their gold museum. It was right outside the main vault where they have the huge nugget.
Yeah.
But my version of the story goes along with the nugget, and it's on display there.
Yeah, and you tracked it down and bought it, and there it is. How fabulous. Glenn, it's been just wonderful having you today on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm always looking for an outlet for my doggerel or mongrel.
Well, I love your doggerel and your mongrel, and they are welcome here anytime. I'll have a bowl of kibble for you. So, thank you so much. And to all of you, have a great week. Look forward to seeing you again next Sunday at 9. Take care.
You've been listening to Manzanita Voices, a production of the Manzanita Writers Press, an affiliate of the Calaveras County Arts Council.